This is a summary of homeland allergies by bestbookbriefings.com. Homeland Allergies, a novel by Iyad Akhtar, Family Politics, 1. On the anniversary of Trump's first year in office, the first time my father met Donald Trump was in the early 90s. They were both in their mid-40s and coming out from under financial ruin. Trump's self-named organization was crumbling under the weight of the debt he piled up, his mistress was newly pregnant, and his ex-wife was destroying him in the public's opinion. It was no surprise to anyone when he started experiencing heart palpitations. One morning, he collapsed face down on the sidewalk. The evidence pointed to a cardiac event, but the doctors couldn't find anything abnormal in his heart. In the EKG strips, they found an occasional, unidentifiable pattern. The news would shortly find their way to my father. My father was an accomplished cardiologist. In 1983, he took a weekend seminar on real estate investment and immediately began funneling money into various properties. Gas stations, strip malls, trout lakes. The market crash in 87 wiped out his entire net worth, so he returned to his position as a medical professor and threw himself into his research. After 3 years, he found himself at the top of his field, with an award for his studies on a rare heart condition known as Brugada syndrome. As one of the leading experts on the subject, my father was flown into Mount Sinai Hospital where he was to meet with Trump. He didn't show. That night, he would call my father and apologize. The next morning, he showed up on time with 2 cups of coffee and a small gift box that contained a love life. Lapel pin. All it took was that worthless trinket to earn my father's allegiance. For 4 years, Trump flew my father to New York every 6 months to perform a regular checkup. But when Brugada was determined to be impossible, the visit stopped, and he never called again. My father went into a kind of mourning. Just the mention of Trump's name would send him into a brooding silence. Under the guise of attending some conference or other, he would make his own trips to New York, revisiting the places he had once dallied with Trump. I would later find out that he'd also taken to calling a hooker by the name of Caroline, who Trump had recommended himself. Suffice it to say, Trump had a lasting effect on my father and my family at large. So when his candidacy was announced, my father, a Pakistani immigrant, supported Trump, well past the point of rationality. A blow-by-blow account of his enthrallment, then disappointment, confusion, and finally exhaustion, a granular account of my father's addiction to what Trump represented might be of value, but I don't know if I can bear writing it. I love my dad. I think he's a good man. Suffice it to say, we were at odds, and my father was willing to pull whatever justification or mental gymnastics to back Donald Trump's behavior. Once it was clear he was going to win, I called my father, "Did you vote for him?" I asked. "God damn it, I'm not talking about this," he said. And then he hung up on me. He never did tell me if he did, but the shame in his voice was clear. I've wondered what he was thinking when he voted for the man. What did he see in Trump that he so admired? A vision of himself, impossibly larger and enhanced. A man free from consequence, totally individualized and self-absorbed. A promise of how much larger his American self could be than the Pakistani one he'd left behind. In America, you could have anything, right? If an idiot like Trump could get a hold of the presidency, couldn't you? Even if you didn't really want it. Just so you knew you could. Trump's ascent to office is the completion of the long-planned rise of mercantilism. Not the collapse of democracy, but the upholding of wealth as a holy pursuit, which seems to be the last American passion left standing. 2. An autobiography of Bin Laden, almost 10 years after 9/11, I wrote a play where an American-born Muslim confesses that as the towers fell, he felt an unexpected sense of pride which made him realize that despite his commitment to being an American, he still somehow identified with the mentality of what he saw as the enemy. Later, the only other Muslim character refers to the attacks as something America deserved, and likely only the first of many. After the play won a Pulitzer and was performed all around the world, I would be asked one question more than any other, was the play autobiographical? Did I share the same views as the characters? Where to begin? How to speak of the vein of hurt and bitterness that opened up in my mother when the man she loved was killed? Not my father, but one of his best friends from medical school, Latif. My mother was connected to Pakistan in a way my father never was. She'd grown up close to the borderline that separated it from India and had witnessed the bloody segregation of Muslims from Hindus and Sikhs firsthand. Living through those events gave her a fear for her life, one her body carried with her even as she sat in her suburban American kitchen, 25 years removed from the trauma. I knew her as a quiet, tense woman, but the oddest things would soften her, making her look like a different woman entirely. Polka, tea roses, Reese's peanut butter cups. Latif. When my mother met Latif, he was in his third year of medical school, and already betrothed. He was a big man, half a foot taller than my father, and 100 pounds heavier, but gentle and kind. When he and my father moved to America, my father immediately threw himself into the American lifestyle. Latif didn't want to forget where he came from. A devout Muslim, he never missed prayer or a fasting day. On Sunday mornings, he initiated a free clinic at his office. It was clear that it was where he belonged, in service to those who needed him. As part of their extended proxy war with America, the Soviets moved into Afghanistan in the 1980s in a battle that would reach Pakistan soon. News of the war changed Latif. An evil empire was slaughtering fellow Muslims while he sat there, raising children who complained about marshmallows in their cereal. He grew stricter, more serious. We saw the Mujahideen fighters of Afghanistan as noble freedom fighters, holy warriors willing to die for something more important than themselves. For Latif, it wasn't enough to send money anymore, he needed to be there to help. So he and his family moved back to Pakistan. At first, the Americans were willing to work with him, setting up a clinic that would treat wounded fighters, train field medics, and help the poor. He was doing everything he could, save for picking up a gun and heading to battle. In 1998, my father received the news that Latif had been assassinated as part of a raid on Al-Qaeda, nothing more than a bullet in the head. It was on CNN, the narrative being poor brown ignorant hordes flocking to Osama bin Laden, an evil manipulator. None of the reports mentioned that Latif was an American citizen. My mother would never be the same afterwards. 3. In the names of the Prophet, the year is 2008, in the suburbs of Abbottabad, the city in North Pakistan where in 3 years, Osama bin Laden will be found and killed. It was no surprise that he was hiding there. Abbottabad is a military town filled with soldiers, cadets, officers. My aunt Ruxana married a colonel by the name of Nasim, a proud, stout man. She'd spent most of her life living there, and now she was very sick with the leukemia that would eventually take her. Father and I had come to visit her. Seeing the wave of paranoia that rose in the country after 9/11, I'd resolved myself to stay calm and listen before I spoke. Father had made no such promise. Dinner was a tense affair. September 11th was an act of war that was tactical genius, Nasim said as he crunched into an apple, studying my father's expression. I'm not saying it was a good thing, but it changed the history of how war will be fought. Genius, Nasim Bhai, my father said, his tone sharp. Look at the chaos it started. The effects of war are always personal, but war itself is the least personal thing. War is just politics by other means. You cannot make the world as you wish to see it unless you are willing to fight for it. Muhammad, peace be upon him, did this better than anyone ever did. He was the best of men, but he was also a great military man. I said nothing. I knew that to him, and to so many Muslims, the Prophet and his first followers were the wisest, most courageous members of humanity. The perfect blueprint for existence. I wish I had. The principles Nasim touted would be central to ISIS, the social and military project that would bloom in Syria and Iraq, a twisted, demonic reflection of the first Muslim community. The next morning, we said our goodbyes and walked out to the car Nasim had hired to take us back to the airport, a blue Mercedes driven by a dark young man by the name of Zaid. He was clearly a religious man, his hair framed by a tight white kufi, his every movement accompanied by a quiet Bismillah al-Rahman, al-Rahim, in the name of God, most good, most merciful, when he opened the trunk, when he laid our bags inside, when he opened the car doors, when he turned the key in the ignition. Father rolled his eyes. We drove in silence until Zaid received a call. It was about his son, who'd been burning with a fever. Zaid and his wife had been looking for a doctor to see him, but couldn't find one. Overhearing this, my father insisted on helping. And so we made a detour to the town of Hazanabdul. I can only describe it as a shanty town. Everywhere there were ramshackle structures built from dirty cloth, broken bricks, rusted metal. Dogs foraged and children played in piles of garbage and debris. The car's wheels sloshed through a canal of thick, black, liquid, clearly human waste, and finally we made it to Zaid's house. As my father leaned over to inspect the child, I stood by the side. Zaid offered me a cigarette. Is it true that your father is a famous doctor in America? He asked. I told him he was. Mashallah, he said. Osama is always a lucky one. Seeing my surprise, Zaid laughed and explained that he was referring not to bin Laden Sahib, but to his son, also named after the Prophet's grandson. As a child, his namesake asked the Prophet if he could join him in battle. Once he was 17, the Prophet allowed him, and he became a great fighter, the youngest general in his army. I worded the question as carefully as I could. Do you hope your Osama grows up to become a great fighter too? Zayd beamed. If he can give his life to make the world better, to live up to his name, then what greater blessing could a father have? Scranton Memoirs. 4. God's Country. In 2010, my car broke down on the I-8, the exhaust sending out plumes of white smoke. A Pennsylvania state trooper pulled me over, his measured, cheery tone showing he only meant to help. While we waited for a tow truck, he asked me where my name was from. I knew he was really asking where I was from. While I am of Pakistani descent, my name is actually Egyptian. Mentioning either of these countries in a conversation can often be a prompt to lead to other, more prying questions, riddled with the sort of growing distrust I'm keen to avoid, especially after 9/11. I told him it was Indian, and that I was from Wisconsin. It was Sunday. The tow driver told me I'd need to wait until Monday evening for someone to take a look at my car, so he dropped me off at a hotel. My anxieties came to me in my dreams, which I unpacked immediately upon waking, a writing practice I'd picked up on in college. The revelations came thusly. My Uncle Shafet was remarrying a church-going Virginian by the name of Christine. There'd been rumors that he was going with her on Sundays and thinking of converting to Christianity. Later he officially changed his name to Luke. It came as no surprise. He'd been at a bar not far from a naval base. A military man himself. Perhaps it had made him feel more at ease than he should have ever allowed himself to be. I doubt he'd only had one beer. He'd explained to his fellow bargoers that as much as we hated the Taliban, we'd do well to remember that they had once been on our side, and they hadn't always been the monsters we made them out to be. It was no surprise that when he left the bar, two officers met him with a report that he was making threats against America. That they hurled him to the ground, stepped on his face, and twisted his arm so far behind his back he later had to have his joint replaced. Cuffed and thrown into a cell with a psychotic war veteran, who started wailing on him when he heard the officers call him an American Taliban. No surprise that as my ankle cowered under the kicks and punches, he saw the officers pop open a can of beer and settle down to watch. The vet broke two of his ribs and landed him in the hospital. Shafet was almost charged with drunk and disorderly conduct and the attempted assault of a police officer, but when it was clear he wouldn't be filing a complaint, the charges were dropped. No surprise that Luke felt safer. Luke would finally belong. The repair shop called. Repairs would cost $900. I didn't have the money, but I had a card with enough credit to cover it. For 5 years, I'd been transferring balances, applying for new credit lines. I was carrying close to $50,000 of debt at that point. When I showed up later that afternoon, the mechanic told me I owed them $2,500. Something about replacing the catalytic converter. My heart thumped in my chest. I said I didn't have that money, and I hadn't asked for a new converter, and could I please have it back? The mechanic was unfazed, said there was nothing he could do. I said he'd done the repair without my consent, and that maybe we should call the authorities to sort this out. The police, he said. Sounds great. I've got them on speed dial. My wife works there. You met my nephew the other day, the state trooper. He says you're Egyptian. Funny that. Was he lying? What did it matter? The man had my car, and I was a Muslim with a funny name. I called my bank and asked to have my credit limit increased. The balance owed on my card more than $15,000 would now be collecting 22% interest. I could have found a local loan shark and saved money. When the woman on the phone was done with her spiel, I thanked her enthusiastically and hung up. I drove home in silence, the wheels rumbling on the asphalt, the wind whistling through the cracked window. My mind was made up. I was going to stop pretending I still felt like an American. 5. Riaz. Or the Merchant of Debt. I left Scranton with a debt that would take me 2 years to pay off. But the decision I made there would lead me to make a series of works based on my American conflict. These works would later lead to my success as a writer and to Riaz Rhind. Riaz was incredibly wealthy, a founder of a Wall Street hedge fund called Avicenna, and the Riaz Rhind Philanthropic Trust, an organization that sought to change conversations and improve lives. The conversations he wanted to change were about Islam, and the lives he wanted to improve were Muslim. Riaz's ultimate ambition was to change not only America's policies, but also the people who govern it. It was the only way Muslims would ever be truly welcomed. We were introduced at a play I had in New York. He related to the struggle of the Muslim characters in it, had worked in the same law firm the main character had. He brought me into his inner circle, introduced me to powerful people, and involved in luxurious, extravagant events. Despite his opulence, Riaz was a pragmatic man. Any friendships or relationships came second to his ambition to build a better America for Muslims. The most he ever told me about himself was after my mother died. She dealt her estate, almost $300,000 in total. I come to him for advice, and he told me a story. When he was young, his father had attempted to start a mosque, first in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, and later in Scranton. He hadn't been a religious man, but in his time in America, he'd learned to substitute for his homeland. He and his friend got together and got a lease on an empty storefront. In less than 2 months, the new mosque was open, but there was trouble from the start. Harassment upon harassment fell onto the mosque, with no support from the law. Riaz's younger sister attempted suicide, and in the ICU the sheriff demanded to know how often the father beat his children. This was too much, and Riaz's father shut down the mosque and moved to Scranton. The factory where Riaz's father worked began laying people off, and in his desperation he developed a solution to increase profits that lost 85 people their jobs. When he tried to start a new mosque, all the people who hated him barred him from ever receiving a permit to do so. In 1983, the factory was shut down, and Riaz's father finally lost his job. Riaz's sister attempted suicide again, and succeeded. Riaz's father fell to pieces, and never fully recovered. Neither did Riaz, I thought. You can understand why I wanted a life where I was never at anyone's mercy, Riaz said. I did. He offered to invest my mother's money in one of his new companies, and I agreed. The company made a tremendous profit by buying up debt in the housing market. Within 2 years, I sold, now a multimillionaire. But it didn't stop there. The company's profits kept rising at the expense of a handful of small municipalities who'd invested without knowing how high risk the assets they were investing were in. It ruined those towns. I recognized two Wilkes-Barre in Pennsylvania and Scranton. I would later learn that all of these towns had barred the construction of mosques. Pax Americana, 6, of love and death, the tumor had fused to my mother's spine by the time it was discovered. No amount of surgery or chemotherapy could remove it. She'd put herself through the process thrice in 30 years and was determined never to do it again, which meant resigning herself to dying of the illness. By the end, she was reliant on a combination of painkillers, which if not lined up exactly right, would result in a massive wave of agony tearing through her body. Most of the time, though, she slept. I would sit beside her and wonder if there was something haunting her past her own body's torment, beyond the fear and pain. I wondered what questions about her life still lay unresolved. I knew there was mostly no point to it, but I did it anyway. It brought me to realize that I had never felt truly loved by her. I'd never known who was loving me. Never felt sure that she knew who she was loving in me. She loved books, and I loved them as a way to connect to her, written them in pursuit of an attention I could never quite grasp. One of my last proper conversations with her was about home. About Pakistan. I'm so sorry, Mary John, she'd said. You were always so happy back home. I never saw you like that here. I never liked it here. The emotions on her face had never been so clear. Her beauty was heartbreaking. Why are you apologizing, Mom? I was happy that you were happy. It was nice to be with family. I'm sorry we brought you here. Mom, I've had a good life here. I'm happy. She frowned. I don't think so. I get to do what I love. I'm a writer. That makes me happy, she said. You're one of them now. Write about them. Not about us. 7. Langford v. Reliant, or How My Father's American Story Ends. In October 2012, my father saw a patient called Christine Langford, a newly pregnant young woman with a heart condition that ran in the family. She'd been diagnosed as a child and had been taking beta blockers to regulate her heartbeat for years. But when she got pregnant, she read an article that warned of potential risks of taking her medicine to the child. She called her doctor and was referred to my father, then the state's leading specialist. He advised her to discontinue her medication until they could run the necessary tests. However, as a specialist, he could only give her the information. The decision would have to be between her and her cardiologist. Christine pressed him for a more definite answer. If you had a daughter with my medical history, what would you tell her to do? I imagine my father already about to leave, pausing to think. Finally, he says I would tell her to stop taking her medicine. Christine took his advice. She died after 2 weeks. Her unborn child went with her. The first I heard of any of this was on the morning I fished my father out of jail. Benji, my childhood friend and deputy police chief of the town where I grew up and my father still lived in, called and told me father had been drunk, kicking up a fuss in the new casino in town. Benji had brought him in, more for his safety than anything. Ever since my mother had died, father had been getting worse. Benji hoped it would serve as a warning. The morning after I picked him up, my father told me everything. He was being sued for malpractice by Christine's family, and the company that had bought his medical group was backing him up in court. I stayed to keep an eye on him, but night after night he would sneak off and end up in one casino or another, drunk and raving. I'd always bring him back. Father and I mostly avoided talking about Trump during his first year as president. I still remembered the rift that had grown between us during the election, and I didn't want to go back there again. Still, I felt him coming around. When Trump fired FBI Director James Comey, when he refused to condemn the white supremacists who rallied in Charlottesville, when he promised to build a great big beautiful wall. Bit by bit he conceded that the man he'd known all those years back might have changed, the weight of responsibility might have twisted his character. But it wasn't until one day at a gas station when we were assaulted by a blonde man with a gun that father finally admitted his feelings. He finally came out and said it. Trump was a big mistake. On the last day of October, while my father was attending an afternoon session of his second week in court, a pickup truck plowed into a group of pedestrians, killing 8 people and injuring 11. The perpetrator was Muslim and Uzbekistani immigrant. The company that was backing father's case decided to settle with Christine's family, effectively disbarring him from practicing. It was time for my father to retire. He called me, asking if he could use my card to book a flight to Pakistan with his friend who was going to visit his injured mother. Father had maxed out his own cards. Was he having trouble with money? I asked. It's a long story, he said. The next day, he called again. Was I free for dinner? He'd booked a room at the Plaza in New York, and somehow he'd scored a reservation at 11 Madison Park. I said I was. I needed to know what was going on. He wasn't alone. Sitting beside him was a woman in red, the prostitute he'd slept with and fathered a daughter with, Caroline. I was furious. I stormed out of the hotel and found myself crying on a park bench. The tears were coming from a pain in my chest, from a heart I'd always known was broken. Hadn't he and mother given all they could to me? Why hadn't it been enough? I felt my phone vibrating, pulled it out to see 2 missed calls from him. I had to go back inside. I couldn't pretend I didn't need him. As I headed back, I saw him outside, helping Caroline into a cab. Dad, I cried out. Dad. I crossed the street. He wouldn't meet my gaze. I'm sorry, I said, crying again. I didn't know what for, but I had to. No, he said, shaking his head. No. I pulled him towards me. He resisted my embrace. No, Beta, no. But I pressed him to me, holding him as tightly as I could, until he stopped resisting. When he spoke, I realized he was crying too. I lost it all, he wept into my shoulder. All of it. I didn't need an explanation. Only the embrace between us mattered. If I could only hold him closer, hold him longer, then maybe what was broken in the two of us would finally heal. I wonder if father knew he wasn't coming back from his flight. He left behind a slew of liabilities, unpaid debts and loans, all of his assets and accounts emptied to fuel a gambling habit to the tune of almost $2 million. He'd been thinking of escaping for quite some time and had empowered his attorneys as necessary. By May of that year, the house I'd grown up in was sold and repainted, leaving nothing but our family photographs behind. The social security benefits were enough to give him a stable, if modest, life on his inherited estate in Baja Walper. I knew we missed each other, but I could also tell he was doing better than he had in years. He wasn't drinking nearly as much and had no way to gamble in an Islam country. Pakistan, the country he'd hated for his entire American life, was his homeland again. America. He found it hard to believe he'd spent so much of his life there. As much as he'd always wanted to be an American, he realized he'd just been playing a role the entire time, and now he was tired of it. I had a good life there, and many good years. It gave me you. I'm grateful to America, but I'm glad to be back in Pakistan, Beta. I'm glad to be home. Ayad Akhtar is an American-born novelist and playwright of Pakistani descent. In 2013, he won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama and an award in literature from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. His work has been published and performed in over 24 languages. Whether you prefer to read or listen, we have something for you. Visit bestbookbriefings.com now for more summaries.